Podcasting from Alexandria, Virginia, just a few miles from Washington, D.C., where we all hope doing what is right the first time is everyone's top priority. This is Software Quality Today, presented by TX3 Services, where we empower life science companies to digitally transform their software testing. This is a podcast for industry professionals about the trends and challenges of software quality testing, computerized systems validation, and the people who are leading the way. We'll be providing you with interviews from special guests as well as news from thought leaders at leading life sciences organizations and vendors alike. And now, here's your host, CSV expert and VP of Strategic Solutions at TX3 Services, Dory Gonzalez-Azevedo. Hey everybody, Jason Cicola here. Welcome to another edition of Software Quality Today. This one's going to be a little bit different than normal. Usually you'd hear Dory starting off the podcast, but today we're actually going to have Dory be the guest of honor, so we can give the audience a little bit of a get to know the host episode and a little bit of context on her background. So, Dory, I know you'd be doing this with other guests normally and doing the interviewing, but thanks for being on as a guest yourself.
Thanks, Jason. I'm really excited. I know this is something we've been talking about for a while, so I'm glad to be able to finally get to record it with you.
Yeah. We've had to reschedule a few times, but that's kind of the way things go. It's all right.
So we've been busy.
Yeah, that's very true. We'll get into some of that as we go through some of the questions and some of the other things we're going to cover. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to start with is, why did you want to start a podcast with TX3? What kind of gave you the idea to do it? And, you know, what are some of the podcasts that you like to listen to that maybe kind of inspired you to get this started?
So that's a great question. I think the primary goal for me in starting and wanting to get a podcast started for TX3 was looking at how to get our message out there in the most efficient and concise way to people like me, right? Like that are super busy, that want to keep learning and doing something to progress their career as well. And so I thought that the podcast platform would be one way to do that. I listen to podcasts a lot during my downtime, if I have that, whatever you call it, downtime. And because I find it a really efficient way to get, you know, exposed to new thoughts and ideas, right? So, you know, from Sam Harris to Peter Attia, two of my favorite podcasters, but, you know, also fun ones like Dax Shepard and all those sorts of folks that are doing some really great and creative things out there, ways to connect with others. So I thought, hey, let's start this and see where it goes.
Yeah, I got to say, for my money, I think podcasts are the best thing to come out of the internet. I mean, I always loved radio growing up when I was a little kid and then all the way through. And then, you know, I still, you know, remember obviously having to drive in traffic with whatever radio show was on and the limitations of that, one with commercials and then two, just who was on at any given time, right? And then now with podcasts, you can listen to really anything, anytime you want, all the time. And I probably should lean a little bit more on the, you know, enablement education side of podcasts, but I think I lean more towards kind of the nonsense side of things. But so I guess let's give everybody a little bit of background on yourself. So let's go back a little ways and where you started, a little background on your education, on your professional career, and just give us a little bit of history.
Sure. So I started off in really kind of jumpstarted my career in active pharmaceutical ingredients, developing small molecules for a generic manufacturer. And so that's a lot of big words in a short period of time. And kind of really what that was is being an organic chemist at a very large scale, organic and inorganic chemist. And I got my degrees in chemistry, biochemistry, and inorganic chemistry, very specific types of chemistry, which led me to only a few sort of jobs, right? Like it was very narrow niche sort of work that I could do right out of grad school. So it was the best choice, though, that I ever made. And why I say that is because moving to Johnson Matthey at that time and place in 1998 was the start of something that I never knew would happen is what I'm here today, right? So back in 1997, Part 11 was released, and we had no idea what it was, but we were making drugs in large scale, and we were using computer systems to do a lot of that stuff. And we had to make sense of all this. So it was kind of like we made it up as we went along, which was pretty cool. Really cool for me as a chemist, frankly, and kind of who I am as a person, like liking to make stuff up as I go along and experiment with things. And so I had my first FDA pre-approval inspection in 2000 and had to defend some old systems. Folks might not that understand the QMOS and old LIM systems and old learning management systems and equipment information systems that still some exist today and some don't anymore. But it was my foray into what has now been a over 20-year career. I never would have thought that that's what I started and walked into.
Now, I'd imagine that you probably had a proclivity towards, or you excelled in chemistry in high school, and that kind of led you into pursuing that academically, right?
Yeah. So actually, I was supposed to be a doctor. Okay. That kind of other life circumstances happened and didn't go to medical school. So I had to earn a living, and I had to earn a living fast. And so making drugs was the next best thing.
Now, for someone who, barely got through my first semester of chemistry and then had some sympathy taken on me by the teacher who made me a TA for the second half of the school year, just explain the sort of college experience of going through that focused of curriculum and that sort of difficult of a track to take. What was that like getting through? Because I'd imagine for most people, it's tough to envision.
So it was very fast tracked, and I actually finished undergrad in 3 years and did a NSF fellow at University of Maryland in my senior year before moving on to Bryn Mawr, where I worked as a graduate student and did my graduate work. I don't think I ever took more than a semester, I think, of English. my summers were full of physics and organic chemistry, and I love science, love all parts of science, as well as math. Math is a strong point of mine as well. My kid asks me today of like, you know, what do I use on a day-to-day basis? And I share with her, frankly, like, I don't use almost any of what I did in college on a day-to-day basis. But what I do use on a day-to-day basis is the critical thinking that very much as part of my education and nature of critically thinking and looking at things, dissecting systems, right? Like looking at processes and things not organically, like literally on a evolutionary basis, or, you know, a model of a new building and how to construct a new building and all of those pieces that matter. So very much part of my education has been that systematic thinking and critical thinking that is what I use every day today. How to piece together organic molecules. Yeah, I still kind of know how to do that and specialty in some of the areas, but the scientists that graduate today are actually well above and beyond what I can do, given the gains in scientific and software applications and how to apply it to science today. So the scientists that are coming out of grad school today, it's amazing the things and where we have jump-started from 20 years ago. The amount of throughput and experiments that they can get through and the algorithms and the crunching of data, as evidenced by the COVID vaccine progress that we just had in such a short period of time, is evident in the changes that we've had in our technology, in our scientific technology, in our understanding.
Now, if you could go back, would you have picked the same majors, or would you have given something else a shot? Or if you could
one for fun. So I don't know about for fun. I mean, and you know me, I'm pretty serious about my stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and this stuff is really serious to me. And because when I left doing the manufacturing work, I really wanted to make a difference in the industry as a whole. And being on the manufacturing floor left me with too many kind of ethical quandaries about what was the right thing to do or not do, where in software, it's really kind of, this is what the software does and this is what it doesn't do. And how do you design better software? For me, making the shift out of the labs into software really helped me formulate my kind of lasting impression of how I can change quality within life sciences.
All right. So since we're getting into that side of things a little bit, what was the transition like going from where you started into the IT SQA sort of software side of things? How did that transpire? How did it go? And what was the acclimation period like?
So it's actually interesting because we're getting ready to interview Mike Fannin, right, for our podcast this week. And we'll talk a little bit about that because my transition moving to human genome sciences was the first full-time foray into transforming a risk-based approach for a CSV model in my move to human genome sciences with Mike and his team when they were there. Before that, I was really doing quality systems overall, right? Like looking at Kappa systems and looking at deviations, quality audits, qualifying a plant, right? And making sure that all the other quality systems were working in a much broader sense. But the move to human genome sciences was the specific move for computerized systems.
All right. Now it's been, you've been in this arena for a while now, right? Have you ever had thoughts about dabbling in other areas, going back to where you started, or did you just kind of love it and want to stay here?
I'm looking forward to how I can continue to help this industry grow, really. And I think we are at a precipice of being able to take the day-to-day technology and make it even more accessible to folks without the overhead burden of feeling like validation's a bad word, right? And we get that a lot, right? We hear that like, oh, we have to validate this. We have to validate that. Well, it actually shouldn't be that much of a burden. It's about doing the right things in the right ways, right? And I hope to be able to influence that conversation in our industry in the next, this year and beyond.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of, I haven't worked in life sciences quite as long as you have, but long enough to know that I've had a lot of the same conversations a lot of times for a number of years at this point. And a lot of it is very much perception based on with a lot of folks that we talk to, right, on conference floors or whatever it is. And it's kind of interesting to be able to go in and kind of shape how people are going about things or giving them a different way of looking at it and executing it to take away some of those adjectives like cumbersome or clunky or prohibitive, when they're thinking about validation.
Right. Yeah. I think what you're saying and you're summarizing really well is making it an applied science, right? Like, so it's one thing to say, these are the things that we should or shouldn't do as part of Leaven and this and that, right? But it's actually putting practical things in place to make better business outcomes as well, right? And so it's not some theory someone talks about. And I think that's part of the cycle that we get into is people want to, they keep saying the same thing, but in different ways, and things are not changing. And I think that's frustrating to people without some practical, tactical things that an organization can do to change that. That being said, it takes a lot to change an organization the size of some of the biggest clients that we have versus some of the smaller clients we have. That's also another topic that Mike and I are going to touch on. We chatted a little bit about because I think that's really big distinction and how nimble can an organization be really determines how effective that they can utilize all their resources, which means not only the people, but the tools that they have and the investments that they make.
Yeah, well, it's the classic sort of jet ski versus the Titanic kind of model, right?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So speaking of better business outcomes, I've worked with you in a few capacities over the years at a couple of companies, right? But now we're here at TX3. So I want you to let everybody know kind of how you ended up here, your history with the folks at own TX3, and what you're doing over here these days.
Sure. So I've known Jason Teverhart since we worked together at Johnson Matthey. And over the course of his and my career, we kind of crossed paths a couple different ways. But it wasn't until they were at Genlogix that I came back and started consulting for them, helping them out. I've always also been an entrepreneur myself. So I've had my own companies throughout the years, and some are coaching, executive coaching companies, and others straight up consulting companies. And so Jason, Eric, and I have partnered in lots of different ways. And this past year, actually over a year now, I think, that I'm on full time. And I decided to make that move to really help launch the vision for TX3 and where we want to go and how we want to really differentiate for our customers, how best we can help with the expertise that we have here at TX3, which is, I see, is our biggest differentiator. The folks that we have here at TX3 not only care about our customers, they have life science experience across the board that help our customers figure out what's the best solutions for them. And we're not really wedded to any one particular way, but rather we're really keen on listening to the customer, figuring out what their true business need is, and then developing a path to get them there.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, because if you look at all the customers that we work with, and granted, I don't interface with them as often as you do or as at a deep of a level as you do, but you know, even just at a cursory glance, the different ways of sort of achieving the same end result from client to client are very different, right? And that's tool-based, it's process-based, it's people, it's a number of things, but it is an interesting sort of approach that we have to take a lot of times, rather than trying to shoehorn in a one size fits all kind of solution, which I know a lot of folks do. And there's certain degrees of success that can be achieved with that. But I think kind of going about it the way we do helps.
I really do, because I think at the end of the day, it really is a combination of all of those things and things that that we've talked about on the podcast, but also we've done presentations on around the people process and the tools, but also the culture of which you're working in, right? And so, you know, if someone knows and comes to us and says, yes, we want to do this agile deployment, well, I say, great, let's talk more about what you mean by what agile is, right? And what your interpretation of what that might be, and what do you think that the best outcomes are for that? Because if you can talk to a variety of different people, and their definition for agile and what that means to them is going to vary, even though that there's this, you know, agile methodology and agile manifesto all out there, but how it applies to each organization is truly different. So understanding that first and really dissecting the true business need, I think helps be able to get to our customers to the point where they can, you know, really adopt things rather than just saying that they want to do something, right? I think that there's a subtle difference between saying you want to do something and actually doing something, right?
Yeah. How do you think we came about to sort of that approach to working with our, because it's been a longstanding approach going back to the Genlogix days when it was just a life sciences division, right? But it seems like that's always been the way we've gone about things. And that continues. There's variance, obviously. There's been evolutions. But yeah, you know, where do you think that kind of came from?
It's a great question, because I think ultimately at the end of the day, all of us are in it with our customers. So Jason and Eric, even though that they're co-founders, they are in there with our customers, talking to them and figuring out what their needs are. Even though I'm, you know, VP of whatever, it doesn't really matter. I'm in there with the customer, really trying to understand and help evolve that, so that it's not, you know, we're just selling software and we're walking away. That's never been our approach, because the adoption of that and how we interact from the very beginning of our sales cycle to our continued support model is integral into how we work with our customer. And it's probably our biggest reoccurring theme that we hear when we interview customers during our quarterly support meetings or whatever, is that they know that they can reach out to us for anything. And even though it might not be an application that we support today for them, they still feel like a trusted, we're their trusted advisors, right? They come to and ask our opinion. Yet again, another gentleman called me today saying, haven't talked to you in a while. I really need help. Where should I go for this? Right? That happens all the time. And that is all relationship based, right? Over the years of continuing to do the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. If we can keep doing the right thing, those sorts of relationships will just continue to bloom. And then when they bloom, then people go to other companies and then that company pulls us in because they were with us previously. That happens a lot to us. We organically grow because we implemented at customer A and then that customer A sponsor, you know, maybe was there for 2 or 3 years and moved to some other customer. And then they bring us over there because they have the relationship and they really understand what value added we do and bring us in. And that's how we've grown.
Yeah, I'm going to drop in a shameless plug here real quick, just because you brought up his name a couple of times. But with Jason Teffenhart, our CEO, go back and listen to episode 2 if you haven't listened to that one already. Dory interviewed him there, and there's a lot of good sort of context and history provided there also. So we've kind of touched on some of this a little bit so far, but I want to go into a little bit more detail generally and then go into a couple specific topics and how it kind of applies. So you're someone, obviously, I think it comes through who the phrase subject matter expert definitely applies to, right? And I think a lot of people, our customers or prospects included, people that we work with, would be curious about where you sort of see the state of the industry right now. And I don't necessarily mean from a regulatory standpoint, but I just mean where organizations currently are versus where maybe they should be or could be.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of reflection after this year of COVID or more. And I think that there's a general realization that the need for true risk-based approach through a quick, ever-shifting change management process needs to be in place such that it is quality-driven. Mistakes made when you're going fast really can blow up an entire organization. And so I think the combination of the need for or the desire to want to go faster needs to button up procedures and applications and all of those things in order to make that that speed happen for folks.
How often?
So that's, I think, the number one.
Yeah, I was going to say, how often do we get involved with somebody where maybe they've started down that path and they are moving too fast and now they're trying to kind of resolve those mistakes versus how many people have too much trepidation about hitting the gas pedal and then just never really start accelerating, right? And they kind of lock themselves in place, right?
So we actually have examples on both sides, right? So we have examples of customers that have come to us after disaster. They went with either another vendor or whatever, and have had mistakes and then have come to us to clean up those mistakes. And we've also had, on the flip side, folks kind of defer decisions too long. And then what ends up happening, it costs so much more to make those decisions. And because they've been on, you know, whether it's their quality is not ready to make the move, or their CIO and investment folks don't want to make the investment, right? So there's a couple different reasons for the delays side. But when that happens, equally as damaging, right, to the end state happens, right? So you have folks that are 2, 3, 4 versions behind, not only in software, but also their methodology, right? Really strict waterfall that can't even move because they're so rigid. And then you have others that have moved too fast and then can't figure out how are they going to keep this level of change going because they haven't put in the controls in place to make sure that things are buttoned up appropriately, not overly, but buttoned up enough. So I think we've seen examples on both sides of that spectrum for us.
Now on the latter, with the moving too fast without having processes buttoned up, do you think that is that often coming from folks that maybe came from outside the industry and then got hired into, say, a pharma or a biotech company and then tried to basically replicate what they were doing in a non-regulated space? And now they're in the position where they're not really comfortable with compliance or maybe whatever it is, right? Is that generally what sort of the cause is?
We are seeing some of that, right? So there have been some instances where we're seeing some large organizations hire outside expertise. You know, again, it's funny, I was talking about this with someone else earlier in the week, is it's also hard to find folks, new generation of folks that have that level of expertise in software, right? So if this is not something any organization, college teaches, right? How Jason and I have learned has been through 20 years of an education of actually doing the work, right? That is not taught in school. So while, you know, there's great information management programs and computer system programs, right? But it doesn't necessarily talk about the integration between this regulated space and good software development. So how do they marry up together matters, right? I'm interested in trying to help that new generation to be able to do that. And so I think it's listening to both sides as we start somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, we do that with a lot of clients, I think, right? We're kind of in on both sides of the fence and trying to get them to a common objective while sort of appeasing either side at the same time, right? It can be a difficult conversation to navigate, but I think we do a pretty good job, and you get in there and do a really good job of helping both sides kind of get what they want while getting the business what they need and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So half the time, it's not even necessarily about my subject matter expertise, right? It's a matter of being able to listen to both sides equally, come up with a mediation in the middle. So I'm very thankful for my executive coaching training that I've had in my life to be able to navigate those conversations, because I think at the end of the day, that's really what it takes, right? It takes all parties coming to the table and vetting out a solution that everyone can live with.
So speaking of that, let's get into something that a lot of people are kind of looking to maybe figure out how to incorporate. And it's, you know, we've been hearing about it probably too much for too long at this point now, but CSA and bringing a CSA model into the picture. Where do you see that right now as far as people looking to incorporate some type of CSA model? Because it still seems like most folks haven't really delved into it too much. Everyone's familiar with what it is, but maybe there's still trepidation or figuring out how do they apply it or does it apply to their use case, right? It's kind of, what are you hearing from the folks that you're talking to?
Well, I think it's, in some ways, it's the same conversation that we had when risk-based approach was released, when, I mean, really, frankly, when Part 11 came out. I mean, it's the same conversation, I think, what we're having, but in a different way. And CSA, the computer assurance model, wants to differentiate between non-product and product software, which I think is a great distinction for many organizations that haven't yet been able to adopt best practices around a risk-based approach in general, right, in their requirements or their testing, are going to struggle because they already don't have the framework that they need in order to feel comfortable to try to then layer on a whole bunch of new terms or a new way of thinking when you already haven't established a norm makes it really hard for organizations. And I think a lot of the big organizations are still very siloed in their approaches. And so while we're working on more harmonization projects, I call them, like where, you know, customers really want one standardized approach to an SDLC, there are still many out there that have one process for regulated, one process for non-regulated, one process for this, one process for that. And each organization has carved up them up differently, but essentially has created a lot of overhead in having those managed in a very siloed way. Whereas if you want to really deploy a true CSA model, you need a common way to talk about everything first before you introduce a whole nother methodology, right? And I think that's really the struggle for many organizations today, where they want to do the right thing, but the shift from a cultural perspective is so great that unless you get senior executive guidance and real clear direction that this is what's going to happen, you're not going to be able to move. And so that really, I hope that the C-level executives really take that to heart, because I think that's really what can transform this industry, is if having a clear message from them. My experience is people that do the work actually really want to do the right thing. And they're just craving for someone to say, yes, let's do it this way. But there's not enough, you know, singular direction there to get that.
Yeah. And I think we're going to have an upcoming podcast, right? I don't think we can say who with at this point, but an upcoming episode. Yeah. We'll have a good CSA focused conversation with, an expert that we've got a good relationship with. So I think that'll be good.
Yeah.
And we also actually, in one of our community of practice groups, we had one of our clients brought up sort of an interesting use case around their first pilot sort of CSA program that they were going to roll out, and everything that went into it, the approvals, the planning. And it seems like they went about it the right way, really kind of mapped everything out, spelled it out, got the right people on board early. And then now we're able to roll out in sort of a pilot phase, their first sort of CSA program. So,
and they were really smart about that, right? Yeah. They very specifically targeted a group, which is often the approach I take with everybody is, do a pilot, you know, not a proof of concept, a true pilot where you're enrolling the whole group and not just, you know, doing a proof of concept for one or two key stakeholders, but you're actually adopting and trying as an experiment, right? Like, be willing to, we're talking about life sciences here. Most of these companies understand experimentation and should be familiar enough with the concept to be willing to take on, yeah, we're going to try it with these one or two parts of our organization to see how it works, what doesn't work, put in the right metrics to figure out, you know, did we meet our objectives or not, right? Like, and then decide, do we want to roll this? Do we want to tweak it before we want to roll it out? Do we want to just roll it out as is? What are those criteria? And I think that is the right approach. And I was really encouraged by what they were sharing with us.
Now, another area that I know that a lot of folks have been, I don't want to say struggling with, some folks do struggle, right? But it's been sort of an ongoing topic that a lot of people are really trying to get on board with at their organization. And that's kind of dipping more into an agile transformation or an agile methodology, where maybe typically they were rooted in a very sort of waterfall based approach, and making that transition. I know that's something that you've worked with a few of our clients on. So from, I don't know, I'm just kind of curious from your perspective, what have been some of the bigger holdups, and what are the things that some other companies, if they're looking to undergo an agile type transformation, that they should be prepared to think about and do and incorporate as they make that move, which is not an overnight kind of thing, right? It can sometimes be a multi-year roadmap to fully get there, mm-hmm. or as close to it as makes sense, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's parts of organizations that can definitely adopt faster. So for example, infrastructure as a service, right? Where you're really getting your platforms up in a reproducible way using the new technologies that are out there with AWS or Azure or whatever you're using. And that is a really quick win, I think, in a way to get a more agile way of doing business out there. I think historically, we've struggled with when you're doing on-prem deployments, you have to do this qualification, you have to validate all this stuff. But if we are really being able to think of it in a new way, like containerize literally them and think of a new way and get to a more rapid approach or a rapid delivery model in that sort of way, that's one thing. On the agile true software development side, I think the number one thing that we need to really be clear about is what are the requirements that are dictated by predicate rules. And so this has been something that I've seen done in a spectrum and typically on the heavy side, not on the light side, is we're going to write these requirements for these applications and we're going to just write everything, like all these requirements. And as we know, a lot of software today, for the most part, is highly configurable out of the box. And that software is developed by software vendors that invest a lot of money in how they do software development. So is there real need to get into that level of detail and requirements from an end user perspective? My answer is no. And if we can really shift away from that, we can get to a more agile delivery model in those cases. And I do have to caveat all of that by saying, you know, for our customers that do true software as a medical device or medical device testing, those sorts of things, that is a separate category. And those requirements are truly different and need to be, and more detailed, and different types of requirements, however you guys want to manage those. But even in those instances, agile methodologies can be incorporated in a compliant fashion, right? And that is truly what Vera does and helps our customers be able to do.
Now, for all of that in an agile model, in a CSA model, or just a streamlined CSV model, right? A modern CSV model, how sort of important and crucial and necessary is test automation? And then I guess as a second part of that, why do a lot of organizations, not just life sciences, right? Any industry, why do they struggle to really achieve the benefits that test automation sort of promises, the ROI that it promises that's not always attainable for a lot of folks?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. You said the word promises like three times, right? Yeah. I think that promises and practical application are two different things. Deploying a true test automation framework takes dedication and real critical thinking about where and how you're going to deploy that strategy. Not every application should have the same checklist, right? It needs to be a tailored checklist for the applications under test. True SMEs in those applications need to be part of the process about determining what or should be automated. And I see often, too often, unfortunately, I think this kind of blanket way of testing where we're either going to deploy test automation everywhere and not really understand that once you go down that path, the necessary ongoing investment to maintain those tests are just as much, if not more expensive, frankly, than having manual tests being updated constantly. So, you know, when you evaluate an application under test, you need to be really clear about your requirements, how often those requirements are going to be modified or changed over time, you know, leveraging vendor software where possible, and then deploying a test automation strategy that fits for that application. That is where I think we're failing as an industry to really do that. I think that there's been a lot of promises made with this or that software can do everything. Well, software is not magical. It's never been. It always includes some human input, right? And we're not at an AI world where it does it on its own. And so those level of promises, I think, need to be really rationalized with practical outcomes and challenged, frankly. I mean, you know, when someone says something to you like, well, how does that really actually work, right? Like, how is that going to look like in my organization, right? It can't be generalized. It has to fit for use for them. Just like we say intended use is true intended use of that application. Well, how is the intended use of test automation in your organization going to work for you?
Yeah, well, and those are probably the folks that end up having the most success or the ones that are asking those questions up front when we're getting involved and when we're implementing and when we're kind of thinking about a strategy. If they're asking those questions up front, they're probably going to have a higher likelihood of successful deployment and utilization over the long term anyways.
Yeah, it's also going in eyed wide open, right? And knowing that even though you may make some decisions day one or month one, those decisions might change and alter over time too, right? So as you evolve and you think about things and start to deploy things, being willing to shift and change, just like in the pilot program model, right? Where you may roll out a test automation framework to a pilot one or two programs and then need to evaluate and readjust your strategy there. And that's part of the process.
Yeah, even personnel changes, anything like that could happen, right? Especially with such a specific kind of skill set as test automation, right?
Right.
You know, the people can have Absolutely. A very big impact on the success or the efficacy of that type of program.
Yep.
So I know a lot of folks, you know, we've talked about this a couple of times already, but a lot of folks, our clients, lean on you a lot for your expertise and TX3 for our expertise, right? And what we can bring to the table. And I know we've talked about a lot of the challenges that we've seen so far and that have a lot of impact on the people that we work with. But I think a lot of them are doing a lot of really good things and making a lot of good strides over the last, I'd say noticeably in the last 2 to 3 years, especially, it seems like. But I'm curious from your perspective, what do you want to see life sciences organizations, our clients or otherwise, really start to achieve and embrace in the coming years?
Well, I've really been encouraged in the last year or so with the amount of quality folks that want to know more. I think actually now more than ever, I have more quality people asking me or calling me and asking me questions about what do they need to know before they go into a meeting with a technical person. Like there's this much more kind of proactive way in which that side of the business is working across a couple of different big organizations that I think really help the conversation so that it's not just the technical people always asking for the money, right? Because it's always kind of been drawn, pushed by money, right? So-and-so team or the ERP teams need all this stuff, right? It's always kind of the big heavy drivers that drive the programs. But I think what I've noticed is there's a coming around full circle of wanting to understand why does the technical team want all of this and how can we help? How can we be more proactive and collaborate while meeting the requirements too, right? Like it's like there's an education there, but I feel like a lot of the quality side is kind of starting to turn the corner.
All right. Now let's, we obviously work with a lot of clients around the world, right? Global offices, locations, headquarters, whatever it is. Let's say Eric and Jason come to you and say, we need global support and we need an office somewhere. You pick where. Where's the spot that you put the TX3 worldwide office?
Yeah. So I put it in Germany. I probably put it in France. Sorry, not in France, in Frankfurt. And why I say that is because there's a lot of great, it's a great hub for one, mm-hmm. But there's, it is a perfect spot for us to be able to connect with a lot of our customers that already exist. And we have several customers in Germany. And so that is probably where I would choose to go stake out first.
What's the timeline you're going to put on that? 2 years, we'll have an office out there?
Well, we'll see. You know, I mean, we've expanding greatly with our resources in India mm-hmm. right now. And we're really looking to double that size in the next year or so. And we're very excited. We have a great group of folks that work out of our partners in India. And that's exciting. It's really, they're very knowledgeable, but not just about the technology that we sell, but also our business processes, right? And so that's a really nice partnership in that you don't necessarily get that all the time. Sometimes you do third-party agreements and they don't have life science experience, right? Or something like that. Mm-hmm. The folks that we partner with, and we are very specific about that, want to have some life science experience so that we understand and talk the same common language.
Now you had mentioned that Frankfurt would be a good hub relative to a lot of people that we work with and just location, right? Is that one of the reasons that keeps you out on the East Coast? Is because the East Coast is kind of a big hub for life sciences, right? The Northeast, central part of the Eastern region. I mean, even the Southeast in a lot of areas. Is that what kind of keeps you out in the DC area?
No, my husband keeps me in the DC area. Okay. so my husband's a government contractor. And so that is why I'm staying, at least for now, in DC. For me, I'd be continuing to move where most of my customers are. And I'm sad that COVID came, that I do tend to spend a lot of time on site with my customers. And I haven't been able to do that in the last year. And it's been, you know, everyone's been wonderful and great to work with via Teams and Zoom and such, but it's not the same as getting, you know, a group together in the room to go through a design analysis together, to really understand where everyone's at. Some of those subtleties have been lost through our, you know, Teams.
It does seem like a lot of that stuff is starting to come back a little bit slowly, right? I mean, we've got 3 conferences coming up this year that are scheduled to have an in-person component. 2 are going to be hybrid, right? Mm-hmm. We'll see
Right.
The turnout, but then there's like the ISPE conference. That's a big one. It looks like they're going full bore in person at a normal convention location that they would do. So it's promising, right? Maybe towards the tail end of this year, we can start to do more and more of that stuff. And then, I mean,
I'm really excited. I mean, you and I have talked about, there's a lot of things that I want on the list to be able to get there. And I think that this is the prime opportunity to do that. I'm grateful that I'll be able to get out to the West Coast next week and see you and the team out there too, is just getting together as TX3 too has been challenging. I was finally able to see Jason after a year last month, right? Like those are, I would be up there much more regularly and meeting with the team. So it's good to travel again.
Yeah. I mean, usually we do at least once a year, the sales meeting, and then whoever's kind of local will do dinner, that kind of thing. Right. And then it feels like it's been an awful long time since we've been out in the, out in those offices, but.
Yep.
All right. Well, I guess some of the last things I wanted to hit on were just that the last year or so, especially the last few months, we've seen a lot of good things at TX3, a lot of growth, a lot of development, new employees, all of that kind of thing. What do you kind of want to see for, since you're instrumentally involved with what's going on over here at TX3, what do you want to see for TX3 as an organization over the next year, 2 years, and kind of what that means for the folks that we work with?
So one of the main objectives as I'm looking to 2022 planning right now is really seeing how we can continue to explore and expand our, how we partner with our customers. What I mean by that is we have 40 plus customers right now in our subscription model for Vera. And a good chunk of them take advantage of our services around other things, our assessments, other tools and that sort of stuff. But there is still a bunch of customers that I would like to then help expedite throughout their organizations, not just the single point of use, right? We're much more than just a software company. And that sort of message, I really want to make sure everyone understands and takes to heart. We have a lot of great business process reengineering that we do here. We have very talented application management services and integration services from key people in our organization that understand how to connect things. We have cloud services that we're, again, in a compliant way that we can really help organizations deploy their own, right? So even if they want to do their own Azure, but we can help them do that. So there's other ways in which I want to start getting those messages out to not only our new customers, but our existing customers to help them in their journey as they go along.
All right. Well, we're about 50 minutes. I think that's a good amount of time. Yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Well, cool. Hey, let me do a couple of last bits of plugs. Just if you haven't subscribed, just subscribe to wherever you listen to podcasts. We've got a few good guests slated coming up. You mentioned Mike Fannin being one of them. We've got a few others that I don't think we can mention, but we'll get those recorded soon. And then if you're interested in being a guest on this podcast, I don't know if we've ever thrown this out, but reach out to us at info@tx3services.com. Just let us know what you'd like to be on, what you'd like to discuss, your area of expertise, and then we can see about coordinating some time to get the Dory to interview you. I think that's a good thing for us to start doing, right?
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
So excited. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, hey, this was great. Thanks a lot, Dory. And we'll get this episode up soon. Yeah. All right.
Absolutely. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Thanks for listening to Software Quality Today with Dory Gonzalez-Azevedo. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, txthreeservices.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please feel free to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe. Also, be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous episodes. You can also check us out on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter at txthreeservices. This has been a TX3 Services production. Join us next time for another edition of Software Quality Today.